If Biden wins, China wins, because China will own this country. If Biden wins, China will own this country. And hopefully you're not going to be able to find that out. It's the most important election in our history, right now. Most important election in our history.
That was President Donald Trump celebrating Labor Day at the White House by calling Joe Biden a stupid person and criticizing military brass for preferring endless wars. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Howdy, folks.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Tuesday.
So a lot of things in American life, as we all know, begin after Labor Day. The presidential general elections start cooking with gas. Catherine is no longer allowed to wear white shoes. And some people's kids go back to school. God help us all. But I wanted to linger a little bit on the past holiday weekend, even the labor aspect of Labor Day, which we'll get to in a bit. But I'm first eager to hear on a just kind of reality check level, whether our respective holiday weekends were a triumphant return to pre-coronavirus life, Catherine, or was it another indication of the weird new normal? How did you spend your Labor Day, Catherine Mingyu Ward?
I had a fairly normal one for other people. A major permanent change for me, or at least a longstanding change for me in the coronavirus times, has been that I now do the nature, as we have discussed on this podcast. And that is because there is a lack of other good options. And so I am settling for the second best option, which is nature. So I went out and walked around in that nature some more. It was pretty good. So it was okay. I have an education pod, which started last week. And so I am feeling like a real fall return to normal new year vibe. And I am into it.
Except like, did you have an education pod before? Hell no. Did you even know the word pod meant? So you're doing the, just to be clear, and also to, you know, shape my own pod, which is a thing that's happening. You guys are doing like a dry run a week in advance, or how's
no how's school that? Started earlier here, so okay. School has already begun, and our family and two other families have potted up to realize economies of scale and gains from trade or something, and we're starting a pin factory is what we're doing in addition to our pod.
That is phenomenal. Nick, how did you did you have a coronavirus Labor Day or a non-coronavirus Labor Day?
Non-coronavirus. Right. I on Friday night, I went to a movie in an actual movie theater, and I'll talk about what I saw and how I responded to it later in the program. And then on yesterday, which I guess was Monday, none of the days matter, I went to the beach, to Orchard Park Beach in the Bronx, and was around lots of different types of people. And at various points, I went out and ate meals and things like that. So it was a simulation of the before times. New York, Manhattan in general, or Manhattan specifically, is a shadow of its former self. So it's, you know, there's definitely that. It's life during wartime in a lot of profound ways.
How was it the physical experience of being in a movie theater again? Was that did you feel exciting, exhilarated, or what was it like?
It was great. And it also, you know, one of the pre-coronavirus little pleasures of life was going to a theater and absolutely being disappointed by the schlock that you're watching on screen. And, you know, it was nice to feel that. I didn't know if I would ever feel that again.
Suderman, what was your, coronavirus Labor Day or non-coronavirus Labor Day?
Oh man, Nick and I are going to argue about the schlock that he was disappointed in later.
We're going to set aside 45 minutes
for the pod.
So I also went to a movie theater, not over the weekend, but during earlier in the week. That was a little bit more normal. I saw a movie that I would have seen in the movie theater on video on demand in my basement. So in some ways, this is a new normal, right? Is a movie that literally the last press screening invite I got in March for a screening that ended up being canceled. I saw finally this weekend on video on demand. I had some friends over, smoked a big pork shoulder, made some barbecue chicken.
I really thought you were going to say I smoked a big.
Me too. Yeah. Even though I know better, I still fully expected that sentence to end in cannabis.
Just took took a big boneless
pork shoulder wrapped in a Phillies blunt.
Big boneless pork shoulder, sitting sitting over coals and chips, wood chips made from ex Jack Daniel's barrels.
Oh my God.
For like hours and hours and hours. The other thing though was, so Nick mentioned Manhattan being a shell of its former self. I actually went down and went for a walk around the mall. And normally on Labor Day, the mall area in Washington, D.C. would be absolutely ridiculously packed, full of tourists. And it wasn't empty by any means, but it just felt it felt like it was running, you know, at 25% capacity, maybe 10%. And when you know, to get there from my house, you have to walk through the downtown city core. And of course it was, you know, a Labor Day weekend, a holiday weekend, so it's not like the people would have been in offices anyway. But even still, it just felt strangely empty and hollowed out, like almost like I was walking through a museum that was designed to show me what DC used to be like, except there were no people there actually, you know, enacting the things that people did in DC. And it was just very odd to see DC downtown, which I have spent very, very little time in over the last couple of months, and usually would have normally have gone down there at least a couple of times a week. And it's just bizarrely empty. And I actually drove through it in the evening earlier in the week, you know, around 9 p.m. on a weeknight, through the heart of the city near the convention center. And normally you would have seen people out and about. You would have seen people spilled out onto the streets. And there were a couple of places where a few people were sitting outside doing outside dining. But the streets themselves were just empty and eerie in a way that felt like I was, you know, watching I Am Legend or something, or in I Am Legend. It felt very post-apocalyptic.
Was it colonial Williamsburg, but for 21st century DC? Was there like two people there in costume? Asking to buy your hair.
And they were in costume as people who live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's what I mean. I feel like I have very strong childhood colonial Williamsburg memories, which are exclusively being put in the stocks and then somebody in a costume asking to buy my hair at the wig shop. And I feel like I went a lot of times, but only those two things ever happened.
My Labor Day was super normal and super non-normal. The non-normal part was... yesterday on the actual Labor Day, we had our kind of pod inauguration discussion party rosé drinking on the patio. Hmm. So like actually sitting down with fellow parents of five-year-olds and like working out the details of our new education pod, which is really bizarre. But then the normal part of it, especially compared to like Memorial Day, which is I think was back in May, so that's about 4 to 5 years ago. But like back then, kids weren't talking to each other. Everyone was home. Like we went months without kids having social interaction. And yesterday we had, you know, like half a dozen kids just running around happy and playing and doing normal kid things. And I paused for a moment and thought, God, that's just lovely. And it's so much better than how awful it was in May. And I got to say, Nick, I hear a lot about Manhattan. It's remarkable how the, you know, your product, we're all products of the environments that we see. This part of the kind of brownstony Carroll Gardens area, it's like 90% back. It's like streets are full, bars are, or, I mean, you can't go inside mm-hmm. the bar, but like have all this outdoor setting. Almost all of the businesses have reopened and only a few have shut down. There's a few neighborhoods where it's like it's kicking pretty good and you can lull yourself into a sense of that. That's how it is everywhere. And it's just not. New York is a really weird place. And the conversations about New York are also strangely dislocating. But
I would also say that Matt, down in Lower Manhattan, things are really vibrant. Uh-huh. You know, and everybody's on the street, and the absolute number of people you see out is smaller. Everybody's outside because you're not allowed to be inside. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of a weird moment, because if you were just like walking through the streets of Little Italy, say, or Greenwich Village, you might think things were doing okay. But it is because everybody who is out, you know, is out in the street.
Yeah.
It's troubling. Every business owner that I've talked to, whether it's retail or food or drink or whatever, most of them are saying that they're at anywhere like from between 10 and 30 or 40% of what they were doing.
You know what else is you know what else is like feeling pleasingly normal yet also normally crappy is we've got some nice start of the school year like zero tolerance fake freak out scandals. Like we've got like teen panics, they're back, which I'm kind of enjoying. So we have the Benadryl challenge, which is like a terrifying new phenomenon in which maybe teens take Benadryl because it like makes you goofy. So first of all, that one, like really classic first week of September, back to school, like media drug panic. Love that. Second,
the teens are smoking some pork shoulders.
They're smoking the pork shoulders with the Tide Pods and the Benadryl, and it's incredible at their rainbow parties. And also that we managed to have a gun in school scandal, despite the fact that there is no school. We had a school call the cops on a 12-year-old who had a toy gun on his Zoom. And that, my friends, is like the new old normal, abnormal. I feel weirdly comforted by a stupid weapons in school zero tolerance thing and a stupid teen drug scare. Like the nature is healing, guys.
I'm waiting for the virtual rainbow party hysteria to start.
Catherine, that's exactly how I felt about watching Mulan on VOD. So.
Okay, see, there we are.
Was it worth the 30? Are you talking about that later, Peter? I don't want to.
Yeah,
I told you guys. Jump in. 45 minutes. Okay.
Teaser trailer for the end of the show.
For the Communist Party of China.
Red China. I wanted to use the, speaking of like, of
China.
Getting back to the new normal. I want to do the new normal of using a holiday as a gimmick to talk about a thing. So Labor Day, this is a holiday, labor. I'm always struck when our terrific Damon Root writes about it, how important the free labor movement was to 19th century abolitionism and sort of the roots of classical liberalism as it's modernly understood. And so let's talk about labor, because I feel like most of the time that there are discussions in the political sphere about organized labor, they're really kind of dumb, or they're abstracted or dislocated from reality. I think we had Joe Biden today talking about supporting $15 minimum wage. Yay, Joe. Or, you know, Donald Trump saying that we're going to, because of our beautiful tariffs, we're going to stop China from stealing our money to build factories that close down. It's hard to follow, and none of it seems kind of real. But there are actual laws governing labor, governing organizations, and all this kind of stuff. And I want to talk about them, or have everyone volunteer a change in said labor markets that they think would be an improvement over the way that we organize things now. So Peter Suderman, you work for the Congressional Budget Office. Tell us what you would like to see changed in labor law or practice or whatever.
I have never worked for the Congressional Budget Office. I am merely an unpaid booster of their work.
CBO
booster?
Stan?
No, I mean, look, wow.
You're really digging deeper there.
So shoulders for everyone.
I think the thing that sticks out to me about sort of that seems most important about labor unions right now, but maybe just historically or for in recent history, is the power of public sector unions and the way that it has been used for very obvious bad, like against the public benefit recently. And so if you have been following any of the conversation around police abuse over the past couple of months, it has just always come back to and has really exposed the ways that police unions work to protect cops as workers, not just sort of throughout the course of the day and their ordinary work, but particularly and especially when cops screw up and do a bad job, often with deadly consequences. That's a huge amount of what police unions exist to do. And it's a real problem. And similarly, what we've seen with teachers unions over the past couple of months is that they protect their workers at the expense of the public good, at the expense of the students who, and the parents who they are supposed to be serving. New York's teachers union was considering a strike last I heard. I don't know if that's been resolved yet, Matt Welch. You could tell me here.
But
good answer.
Yes, that's where we are with New York's teachers union. They're considering a strike in a time when kids are barely even going to school at all. At a time when parents and students are at the end of their rope and have fewer options than ever, teachers unions have proven a huge impediment to figuring out how to solve the admittedly quite difficult and novel problem of how to educate kids during a pandemic. And public sector unions, I really think are just different in kind than private unions and are a particular problem that public policy because it deals with public employees, has to think about solving and has to think about reforming.
New York, so they threatened a strike to try to get some kind of concessions from Bill de Blasio here, keeping in mind that New York educates 1.1 million kids, or did. It'll be a lot lower this year, I'm sure, in the public education system. And so they delayed the school year it was supposed to start on the 16th. Now it starts on the 21st and adopted some of the things that the unions wanted to have. So it was a threatened situation. But, who knows? There could still be kind of wildcat strikes. And it's been very difficult to plan for parents, to say the least.
Do you feel like the New York teachers unions are making life easier for you as a parent, for your kids as students, for any parents that you know that aren't employed by the city in some capacity?
I live in an area that voted 92% for Hillary Clinton. The amount of hot fire I am seeing by parents against the teachers union here and their role and their attitudes and even just their behavior in PTA meetings is eye opening. People are mad. I mean, 25-year-old teachers, saying, how dare you infect me with your coronavirus kids? And people are like, that's not how it works, dude. But yeah, so this will be a really interesting a few weeks and months about how parents are and the relationship with teachers unions will go. I don't know if they realize how much they are pushing it in terms of public opinion against them and also making people come to all kinds of new and weird considerations about the way that public school is organized.
I mean, Peter, your question, Peter, is like exactly it perfectly reveals the thing that was always like a gap between perception and reality about teachers unions, right? Teachers unions, when they strike, they go out and have the signs about how it's for the children and, all of their platform and rhetoric is about how it's better for children. But they are a labor union. And there's a clear mandate for labor unions, which is that they are trying through basically any means at their disposal to improve conditions for the members of the union, which are not your kids, which are not parents, which are just teachers who, this weekend was looking through photos of some of the New York teachers union rallies to illustrate a story. And the stuff on the signs has switched over completely from like teachers unions, we love your kids and we're trying to make the city better, to, no return until zero cases. We demand safety was one of the signs. And then there somebody had written a parenthetical that was like, for students and parents and teachers. And it was like, yeah, that's not what you meant. And I don't know. I've just been really struck by like the veil is off, like the charade, which was always a very thin veneer. And like, I sort of, part of me says like, don't blame them. Like, that's the job of the unions. People pay their dues and the union's job is to protect them in the workspace, and that they think the way to do their job right now is to prevent schools from opening. But, if people thought their job was something else before, they were confused.
When you have socialists talk about class struggle, they often frame political struggles as labor versus capital. when the labor is public sector, the capital is the taxpayer. And so the public sector unions exist to sort of fight back against you, the taxpayer, who are paying for their services. And it's, we have seen that just highlighted in ways that are unmissable and kind of hard to argue with, I think, more so in the past 6 months than that. It's always been true, right? There's all, it's not that police unions were some other thing 5 years ago. It's not that teachers unions acted differently 5 or 10 years ago, but it is, it's just now kind of unmissable and unmistakable. And you can't really make say that anything else is going on based on the evidence of the last 6 months.
Yeah. And there's, you know, this is the reason, that Peter's talking about why FDR, among other people, were against public sector unions and certain aspects of collective bargaining. I think we might be witnessing, and I hope we are, a one-time shift where the number of households that have kids in schools is, you know, is not massive. So you have a lot of Matt, as alienated as you are, other people who are already kind of a little bit annoyed, probably, that they're paying so much to send kids that they have no relation to school, when they see unions acting like this, teachers unions acting like this. And there are things like school choice, which is coming online not because of policy changes, but because of, you know, of material conditions changing on the ground. This could be a moment where we really reset the table for education. And in terms of actual policy, having public dollars follow the child, which is something that the Reason Foundation education people talk about a lot, is the ultimate goal here. And it is such a better plan. Think about it. If you didn't have to put up with, you know, like a school bureaucracy, but you, Matt, you were actually, or Catherine, for that matter, you were contracting with a school one way or the other, using money that is, you know, the taxpayers have graciously allotted to you and your child. It seems to me this is a message that this is a crisis that we should take advantage of, and a message that we should be sending, and start seeing that multiply throughout or proliferate through other government transfer programs.
I would add to that observation that the two major parties have really diverged on this issue. You see a lot of discussion at the Republican National Convention about school choice, you know, being the civil rights issue of our time. A lot of retweets from people with the last name of Trump, of Corey DeAngelis's pieces, making arguments for essentially backpack funding of, you know, tie the funding to the student and stop with the nonsense. The Democrats, meanwhile, have lost all or most of their appetite nationally for kind of experiments in school choice and in charter schools and everything like that. They've hardened their position on this in a way that's very off-putting. I don't know if there's much left that is capable of, you know, showing any kind of dent in this presidential election, because it's been pretty stable, the polling numbers, for a very long time, and there's just there are no wiggly lines. But I think this will be one of the only kind of potential areas. That's one of many reasons why the teachers unions are spending their time talking not about the local power structure, but about Donald Trump, because they know that they can play to the Hillary voter here, even though it's, we can't, you look at the New York Times, they have published a whole bunch of people who are kind of in my position and, you know, living here and sending their kids to public schools, are like, you know, this is going to suck. Why aren't they open? You know, and New York is one of the only places that even has a particularly strong argument for opening up elementary schools, which is that the testing rate here is, it's been like 0.7% for a really long time. But anyways, New York Times will run columns like this. The first five paragraphs will always be about Trump. This is a local virus, local school system, local mayor, local teacher, everything. It's a local story, and they will throat clear five paragraphs about Trump, because if they make it a national issue, then they can win support to their side, or they think they can. I think that they're gambling in a way, and that there's a potential of backlash there.
Aren't you Catherine, guys also, yeah, though, ahead. Finding, like, I'm having one of those, like, peak moments of libertarian frustration. And I see it in Nick's Twitter feed, especially, where everyone on the American left is really cognizant right now of how bad police unions are. And everyone on the American right is super attuned to how bad teachers' unions are. And it's like, now do the other one. Like, come on, guys, we're almost there. We can do it. And it's like, no, we are not going to do it. And I don't mean to be that libertarian who's like, you're not being intellectually consistent and rigorous. But also, people are not being intellectually consistent and rigorous. And it's very frustrating.
It's very frustrating. any other?
You know, for policy elites, public school is not an issue because they don't send their kids to public schools. And I think that that's a big problem with the way that this stuff gets talked about. And I don't think that they fully appreciate the exasperation, you know, that a lot of parents feel. And again, I think, and I say this as somebody who, you know, went to Catholic grammar school in high school, back in the 70s, there was still a debate about, you know, why am I paying for other kids to, you know, other people's kids to go to school? I think it's worth dusting that off because in most places, education taxes, school taxes are among the very highest. They are the drivers of taxation on housing and thus not only on mortgages, but on rents. And we should be talking about that, because I think it's fine for the state to provide the means of education, but it can be done much more efficiently. And again, backpack funding, getting rid of school districts, as far as the government is concerned, would be a great thing. Give the money allotted to education dollars for K-12 directly to parents and let them figure out what to do. It's a beautiful way of talking about autonomy and helping people in the lower income strata to rise up.
So we mentioned Donald Trump here. So let's pivot to a couple of the comments that he made over the past week or so that have kind of pricked up libertarian ears. If that's a thing way we can say it. I gave an interview with Laura Ingraham last week in which he claimed to be somewhat libertarian. And asserted also that the people who voted for Gary Johnson in 2016 are, quote, all Republican voters who might just come back home to the GOP in 2020. More substantially, I think, the kind of ongoing media scrum over a big piece in The Atlantic by Jeffrey Goldberg having to do with Trump's reported comments at various military crass comments about various military funerals and such like. Back and forth of all of that, Trump has been saying some pretty interesting things. For instance, it's a direct quote, I'm not saying the military is in love with me. The soldiers are. The top people in the Pentagon probably aren't, because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy. Kind of Eisenhower farewell address stuff. You're hearing the military-industrial complex being dropped a lot by the Trump administration. So I want to get into that. Even looking at the Atlantic story, Catherine, only in terms of this, I was on vacation when that dropped, and there was, you know, whenever I duck into Twitter, people were talking about that for 48 hours to 72 hours. I didn't think that there was any one of these things left where people were like, oh, this one's going to leave a mark. People are still.
I mean, we talked about this on the podcast last week or 2 weeks ago, like this incredibly deep desire on the part of people who are already anti-Trump to find the thing that he did or said or is that is going to turn people who are pro-Trump anti-Trump. And I agree. I was like, surely here we are. It's the first week of September, like 4 years into his administration. People have got to know by now that Donald Trump said a rude thing that is a violation of one of our politenesses or political norms is not going to be the thing that tips the election. And certainly a anonymously sourced Atlantic piece reporting that thing is really, really not going to be that. Like, again, I just feel the need to remind all those people who were like, this is it. Remember when we had the audio recording of him saying the phrase, grab him by the pussy? You remember that? Like, This is not worse than that. This is much, much less worse than that. Stop it. It's not going to sway the election. It's just not.
Nick, I am both like titillated and frustrated, not by the tape, but by...
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, thanks for sharing. This is live, by the way. We're on air.
I thought that if my microphone wasn't working, that, it's actually not being recorded. When Trump says these things about the military-industrial complex, you know, the feel like he's sending out the Thad Russell radar, and it's
Thad Russell. He could get all of Thad. Renegade University is going to vote by 60% of 40% in favor of Trump.
According to his comments earlier, like if Gary Johnson voters are 100% Republicans, then we have to proceed from that baseline.
They're 200% Renegade University.
But like he is the commander in chief. It's amazing to me that he makes these comments, which I welcome very much, and not the rude parts and the crass parts, but the like, I don't want to fight endless wars. If we fight a war, we should win. But otherwise, he could have pulled us out of Afghanistan 3 years ago and absolutely did not and is not right now. Does that make you where does your kind of analysis slash frustration of that lie? Is it possible that it's kind of intractable? Like you just can't go against the generals no matter what? Or do you attribute it more to, he has the attention span of a dog chasing squirrels and like doesn't follow up with the power at his own fingertips to do the thing that you would imagine that the logic would indicate that he should do?
A number of things. One is that I don't really trust the Atlantic story, and I think that's important for reasons that Catherine was laying out. But anonymous sources written by an editor in chief and a magazine that has been so in the tank for military adventurism whenever it is popular or when it was Obama or George Bush. And then they always come around and be like, we were wrong about that. We got that one wrong. But, you know, next year, I mean, they are like Dr. Bellows in I Dream of Jeannie. They are forever optimistic that this time the massive intervention that is predicated upon bad information or stupid geopolitics is finally going to work. I don't trust the Atlantic story. It's contradicted by people like John Bolton, who has absolutely no reason to, you know, say anything positive about Trump. Having said all of that, I welcome a president who is willing to say, and there's some reporting at Fox that kind of pushes this line for what that's worth, because Trump is also simultaneously at war with and an ally of Fox News. But that he was, you know, that he, really his ire is directed at generals. And to the extent that we can have a conversation and a discussion and a deep yelling match about American foreign policy in the 21st century, we need to have it. It is true that our generals, by and large, have sucked. And our military interventions in the 21st century have not just been a little bit debatable, they have been disastrous on every possible level. And, you know, the generals have a lot to explain. They have a lot to answer for, and they need to be called out, and they are the ones that we should be having in front of Congress talking about why they make decisions the way they do and all of that kind of stuff. Now we get to the question of Trump as a foreign policy president. The one thing that you can say about Trump, and this is a small compliment, is that he's not as bad as Bush or Obama have been on foreign policy. I think it certainly in terms of military interventions, he has failed to deliver on getting us out of endless wars, and he should be held accountable for that. The luck that he finds himself in is that he's going against Joe Biden, who was vice president for 800 years during the Obama administration, and then he was in the Imperial Senate right next to Jar Jar Binks, the senior senator from Delaware, for like another 1,000 years. Biden has never had a good instinct on foreign policy. So, you know, then you're left with the question of Trump has failed to deliver on promises, relatively speaking, with the exception of Joe Jorgensen. He's the worst candidate, or he's the best candidate in terms of foreign policy.
Freudian slip there, maybe.
Yeah.
Would point out that there's some reporting that Biden was the and this is another damning with faint praise, was frequently the least interventionist in the room when it came to Syria and Libya in the Obama administration, because he reportedly had been scared straight from his various disastrous interventionism support in the
which
past.
Which also explains his support for the Iraq war and various authorizations of military force whenever we find them going back to, you know, sometime during the Vietnam, when the Vietnam was an actual shooting war. So
he was still a junior senator. Suderman, so libertarians and Donald Trump, there's a lot of chatter. Stephanie Slate has great pieces up on Reason right now, kind of talking about the divorce on the broader right between people who are, you know, championing kind of an illiberalism. Is there any muscle memory left in the old alleged alliance between libertarians and conservatives from back in the Cold War time? What's your sense of the relationship that libertarians have with Donald Trump?
Well, the relationship that libertarians have with Donald Trump is that they don't like a lot of the things he has done, and also like some of the things he has done, and also wish he would do more things that they like and more of the things he said he would do that he hasn't done that they would like him to do. And, you know, you can say pull us out of endless wars, right? Like, it's on the one hand, it's great that we have a president who is saying endless wars are bad. On the other hand, again, it is terrible that we have a president who just says it and then doesn't stop the endless wars. He's had 4 years now. He's running on his promise is to do the thing he already had 4 years to do. The first 2 years of which he had a fully Republican Congress, could have done anything he wanted. Instead, he botched the healthcare repeal effort, passed a tax cut like Republicans always do, and then signed a bunch of big spending bills. The military budget has gone up. And so this is, you know, the problem with Donald Trump is that even if you like a lot of the things that he says, he very frequently doesn't deliver the actual policy goods. Let's say you really think that you're sort of like, well, the deep state is bad, the administrative state is a problem and a burden. You even sort of think that he is directionally correct when it comes to regulation. His actual record on regulation is not nearly as good as he and many of his defenders who would like to see a deregulatory, you know, emphasis and push would suggest. It's pretty mediocre, and especially when you account for executive orders, where he has really sort of taken Obama's pen and phone theory of governance and decided that's how I'm going to govern, especially in the last 2 years where he's had a Democratic House. And so the relationship between Donald Trump and libertarians is one of, I think it is best characterized as great frustration, which is to say that there are libertarians, not all, but there are at least some who see in him a promise of some sort of change, a promise of a different direction, and then and even some sort of rhetorical feints in that direction, right? And then when you actually look at the policies that he passes on trade, the military intervention, on spending, on all of this stuff, it is at best kind of it just doesn't get there, and frequently it's actually really quite bad. You know, obviously there's many different views, even on this podcast, about Donald Trump the person. But Donald Trump the politician, Donald Trump the policymaker, is one who is just sort of, who is in some ways tantalizing and promising to libertarians, but also deeply, deeply, deeply frustrating on a daily basis.
I actually, the interview that he gave that we were sort of referencing earlier, I very rarely identify with Laura Ingraham. Like, that's not a thing that happens to me a lot. But I really did watching that clip, because I think there's, you know, all libertarians probably experience this. I would argue it's possibly a little bit more of a, like, Republican man, libertarian lady thing. Even you're chatting with someone at a happy hour at a bar, whatever, back in the before times, and you say, "Oh, I'm a libertarian," and the Republican dude says, "Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a libertarian myself. I think I'm a libertarian," and then they proceed to say not libertarian things because they don't understand exactly what a libertarian is. And to the extent that they do understand it, they mean the stereotype, which is like, yeah, I like drugs, at least, you know, for some people and some drugs or whatever. Like that conversation, watching Donald Trump and Laura Ingraham have that conversation gave me PTSD to a lot of bar conversations I have had with Republican dudes, well-meaning, who just kind of think libertarians are conservatives, or if they think about it at all, think like, I'm Republican, but like, I'm cool, or like, I'm Republican, but I'm not actively racist right now, so I'm probably a libertarian or something. And it's very, very frustrating. The fact that that Trump brandished Rand Paul as his libertarian credentials is something we could talk about more, I suppose. But
he did that at he did that at Freedom Fest in 2015 when we saw him speak. Mm-hmm. The libertarian portion of that speech was as follows: I played golf with Rand Paul. I like him. And then there's nothing else.
Which is better than nothing.
I mean, if you're
it's
being
like
serious,
at least that shows an understanding of like whom around him is in fact the closest thing to a libertarian. So like props. But again, it's that Republican dude who is like dimly aware of Rand Paul, and that's about as far as it goes. That conversation is the one that I was reliving.
Trump is not an ideological thinker. He's not an ideological politician, and I don't think he really. I just don't think he relates to politics and policy in an ideological way, which means that whenever he talks about libertarianism, he's not thinking about it with certainly not with the depth that people on this podcast think about it, but really with any depth at all. It's just sort of it's a kind of half-baked label that he throws around and doesn't understand.
Or it's part of a tribe. You know, he sees libertarians as part of the Republican tribe, and our politics is oriented in a kind of two-tribe, you know, structure right now. And so, you know, there are many Republicans, not just Donald Trump, who just say, like, listen, when it comes down to it and we need to round people up to Republican or down to Democrat, libertarians get rounded up, and that's, and maybe also get rounded up for the camps later. But like the notion is totally embedded in what he said subsequent to that, which was like, I assume all the libertarians would have voted for me, which is a false assumption based on tons of polling, as we've discussed on this podcast many times before. But it's a sides way of thinking. It's a tribal way of thinking.
Is Trump, if you're going to vote for either Joe Biden or Donald Trump as a libertarian, which one is more likely to get your
vote?
That's
literally the whole point of all of reason is like, that's the wrong question.
No. If it's the wrong question, then why aren't we asking Joe Biden? You know, I mean, like people, libertarians, and I say this because I've never voted for a Republican. I don't intend to, and I don't feel a need to explain that. But people are like, oh, the Republicans have abandoned libertarianism. You know, by the same token, what are Democrats doing? The last time I checked, Democrats need every vote they can get in order to win a majority or, you know, to win the White House. And in these conversations, it's like so many libertarians seem terrified to acknowledge that they have anything in common with either the Republican Party or Donald Trump. It gets in the way of having the types of demands on our politics that we need to be having. You know, I don't hear Joe Biden is not in favor of school choice. Joe Biden is not in favor of getting out of stupid wars. Joe Biden is not in favor of virtual, you know, he's not in favor of defunding the police or abolishing the police or changing criminal justice. Or if he has somehow after 1,000 years in power, he's finally getting around to that. You know, and now he's also seriously considering, you know, maybe legalizing pot for the first time ever. He's 78 years old. This guy is a disaster. And I think what libertarians need to be doing instead of like, oh, you know, Trump is, oh, he's so awful and Biden is so awful. You know, we have a positive agenda for change and for an America that is actually fucking worth defending. And articulating and eliciting, because we are the only people who are, you know, we don't want the Chinese killing Uyghurs, but we also don't want tariffs against things that make it harder for poor people. We want school choice. We want drug legalization. We want more immigrants rather than fewer. We want, you know, California, the war on freelancers, which keeps changing to a point now where, you know, they're finally going to say, okay, everybody can be a freelancer except for Uber and Lyft drivers, which is why we passed this idiotic law you know,
which Joe Biden has repeatedly praised.
Loves. I mean, like, we need to start talking in those terms, because that is, after this election, the one thing we know for sure, at least 45% and possibly closer to 60% of Americans are going to be so pissed off with the way that Republicans and Democrats do politics. I think it would be better. That's the question to be asking, is to demand of the major tribes. You know, they need us more than we need them, because we know we're living our lives outside of the political arena to begin with.
Just to throw in the factual basis of Catherine's statement that all libertarian voters are not automatically Trump voters. 2016 exit polls, keeping in mind that Gary Johnson won 3.3% of the vote or thereabouts, along with Joe Biden endorser Bill Weld. Exit polls indicated that 55% of Gary Johnson voters would not have voted. And of the rest, 25% would have voted for Hillary Clinton and 15% for Donald Trump. That's pretty consistent throughout exit polls. So, yeah, it's not an automatic vote at all. All right. I want to devote the last 45 minutes of this podcast to Gillespie-Suderman argument about what movie Nick saw in the theaters. What have you been consuming culturally, my podcast people, Nick?
So I went to see the new Christopher Nolan movie Tenet in the movie theater. I went to the Bowtie Cinemas of Greenwich, Connecticut, took a train from Manhattan, and it was a delightful excursion. It was great to eat too much movie theater popcorn. I am still drying. I'm still like trying to get the salt taste out of my mouth from the gigantic bucket of popcorn that I think I fell in by the end. It was so big and so delicious and tasty. The movie itself is a
complete mess.
Wow, can
I subscribe to your popcorn review newsletter?
Yeah, that was like absolutely. ASMR or something. That was very evocative.
Gourmet popcorn of some sort, but basically it was just like a big bucket of salt with some stuff in it. But Tenet itself is a hilarious, it's like a mashup of every Christopher Nolan movie. You know, and it's just, it's about time travel. There's my girlfriend and I are joking still about trying to use temporal pincer in every conversation that we can work it into, because some people are moving through time, you know, forward, other people are moving backwards. And Matt, it's a temporal pincer movement.
Yeah.
Of course. Classic. You know, we got to do that. Yeah, of course. You know, it makes so much sense when you think about it that way. It is,
I feel like libertarians are caught in a temporal pincer movement between Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
No, they're both the past, I think. You know,
we're moving forward. They're moving backwards.
The beautiful ones not yet born are our future. But in any case, it was worth seeing. It was worth seeing in a movie theater. I do not think it is worth seeing on a small screen or even a large screen TV in the privacy of your own home with, you know, like either, you know, microwave popcorn or something like that. But I highly recommend people go out to movie theaters the minute that they can. It's a delightful experience, and it's something that has gone missing. And it's, you know, like the smell of flowers on a riverbank. Or something, you know, it's such a huge and wonderful part of American life. And it's really sad that it is so screwed up. We may be going to Hoboken, of all places, later today to see the New Mutants. And the journey there will be much more interesting and fun than whatever happens in the theater, I'm sure.
Hey, Nick, does Hoboken smell like flowers in the riverbank?
You know, I haven't been to Hoboken, and I prefer to call it Hoboken, which is from an old Bugs Bunny cartoon, a deliberate mispronunciation. I'll let you know next week, Matt.
Yeah. The first and maybe the only time I went to Hoboken, I was with a friend from Jersey and who's been involved in journalism and politics there forever. And we were walking around. And this guy walks up and goes, Hey, Jimmy, to my friend. And my friend's like, hey, Mayor, how's it going? And it's like, so the mayor is calling out Jimmy. And then the mayor, like, I think is still in the federal pokey. Then so the only time I met an official from Hoboken, it was an obvious, criminal. Peter, do you want to speak in favor of Christopher Nolan?
Yeah. So, I mean, like Nick, I just really enjoyed going back to the movie theater. I don't know that how long it has. I mean, it's been about 6 months since I saw a movie in the theater. The last movie I saw before this was The Hunt at a press screening on, I want to say, like March 9th or something. And, you know, it's just a very strange thing. I typically go to the movies about once a week, sometimes a little more, and have for the better part of my life. I mean, it's possible that I was single digits years old the last time I went a full, you know, 5.5 months without seeing a movie in the theater at all. So just being back in a theater was great. And Tenet is a movie that is best experienced in a movie theater, even if you don't totally love it, as I think Nick did. It's just such a big and extravagant and overwhelming experience, and it's designed to kind of pulverize your senses. It has this just ridiculously kind of blammy sort of spastic staccato score that takes all of the Christopher Nolan tricks score wise to the next level. I think though that is the way to experience, and that is where the movie's actual greatness lies, is in the way that it is overwhelming and the way that it totally overtakes your senses in a theater. And people, have complained that it is a little hard to follow, and it's true. It's a little hard to follow because the exposition
now, it is impossible.
It's
to
so
follow.
Once you read, I mean, there's a really
yeah,
good
once you read
plot
like several thousand words,
and when
of
I read
the plot
breakdown, I realized actually I got like 95% of this. There were one or two details that I missed, because what happens is Nolan is saying, don't try to follow this movie in granular detail, scene by scene, the way you normally would. That's not how this plot works. What he's saying is sit back, feel it, just sort of let the experience wash over you. And at the end, you will have understood it somehow or another. And that's kind of par for the course for Christopher Nolan. And people are mistakenly treating this movie for understandable reasons, like a puzzle that you have to solve, right? They're like, I don't understand. What is it? What's the secret? What's he actually saying? How do you unwrap this like riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a movie theater, wrapped in COVID? No, it's not
in
a puzzle.
Popcorn.
It's not a puzzle. It's a pattern, and it's variations on a theme. And everywhere in the movie, you just see the same idea repeated over and over verbally. You see it repeated visually. You see it just sort of in the structure of the film itself. And it's like he basically was like, I think palindromes are interesting. I'm going to make a movie in which all of the exposition, all of the action scenes, all of the characters exist as palindromes. So even the big expository sequence, it's like the second or third scene in the movie. We've just gotten through that big opening action sequence. And you see our main character, whose name is literally the protagonist, and he's being interrogated by some goons of some sort. You have really no idea what's going on. And where do they have him sitting? He's sitting on a train track. And next to him, you have two other train tracks, one
My
going
God.
One way,
Peter,
one going the other.
Peter, this is going to take forever. Let
My
me,
point
let
is,
me, we, in the
are
past,
you my
we have
year old daughter, Peter.
Like, we have agreed.
The floor is lava.
We have agreed that Christopher Nolan is by far and away the most interesting director, like big budget director, working today. I would argue probably ever. I mean, like maybe Cecil B. DeMille, and in fact Nolan is like really sharp, really interesting. The movie is worth seeing in a theater because of the end of lockdown. It's a minor Christopher Nolan work. I think you would agree it's not in the top three of his movies.
I don't think it's best, but I still love it anyway. I think it's just.
Do you want to talk about what you saw?
Yeah. So
rather than
contrasting.
Yes.
It's worth contrasting this with the other big movie that I saw over the weekend, which is Mulan, which was supposed to come out in March, which I literally, had the press screening invite. It was scheduled to come out in theaters, and then it just didn't, because in March we shut absolutely everything down and no one had a clue what was going to happen for months. And now it's out. And the only way you can see it in the United States is if you pay an additional $30 on top of the couple of bucks a month you're already paying for Disney Plus. And you watch this thing, and on the one hand, it's really kind of a pleasure to see, after like a summer full of video on demand Netflix movies, all of which are kind of pricey and, well made in certain ways. All of those Netflix movies share this characteristic of feeling like first drafts that nobody bothered to edit or think about. And what Mulan feels like is like the 12th or 14th or 20th draft after every single person at the magazine has been over this thing 40 times and it's just polished and perfected. And there's also there's also something about it. Not every person at the magazine, every person in the movie studio, it's like they paid a focus group to make a movie. Because this movie has absolutely nothing wild or rough or interesting about it. It is just a sort of a, it's a paint by numbers luxury epic. And it's, on the one hand, it's like, I have missed those. I go see Disney movies, Marvel films, Star Wars films, all of which are just excessively well produced and also kind of soulless. And on the other hand, it's just like, man, you did not allow this movie to breathe at all. And I will just follow this up with one very short contrast. The movie that I watched right after that, right after Mulan, was Point Break. Point Break, one of the great action films, one of the great Keanu Reeves, with Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze. And that movie is not a movie that feels like a rough draft or like somebody didn't think about it or anything like that, but it just has this spark of wildness to it. The sense that anything could happen and that there's a real sort of, there's something lively and unkempt about it that is just electric and wonderful. And all the Disney movies of this era, of the last 10 years, and I would say the Star Wars films, all of these giant budget remakes like Mulan, you know, which is a remake of a 90s era animated film, they all just lack any sort of sense of unpredictability or life. They do exactly what they need to do in the most lavish and beautiful and extremely well-crafted way, and they do nothing else because they are incredibly terrified of doing so.
I will. Can I just add, please? The only thing wrong with Point Break is that there is not a Gerald Ford among the dead presidents.
That is absolutely true.
The bank robbery gang.
Catherine, save us from the nerds, please.
You know that I am the wrong person to ask for that quest, as always.
You're calling in the cavalry in a steampunk, tank or something
exactly
like that.
Right.
At a
it's
dirigible.
Like, save us from the nerds, yeah. And I came in on my Zeppelin. You know. No,
still cooler.
I will say, like, I have discussed this before. I am firmer than ever in my conviction. Like, don't go to the movies ever, never movie theater. First of all, there are people there. And like now more than ever, don't be in a room with people, I think is a clear takeaway. Second of all, it's like, you know, if you have kids, it's like about $1,000 to go to the movies. You can buy a lot of like extra tickets to Mulan in your house for that. So yes, cost of movie going is too high. Other humans are there. Never go to the movies. I hate it. The end. Popcorn is overrated. Woo, fighting words. But I will say, for things that I consumed, I read a book. But what I want to talk about is that I read this book because the algorithms are good. So a few days ago, I got an email from Amazon, and Amazon just said, hey, we're giving you a $5 credit for books by John Green, because it seems like you like books by John Green, but you haven't read one in a while. Here's $5. And I was like, Amazon, how right you are. I do enjoy books by John Green, and I will use your $5 to buy one right now. And then I did. And then I immediately read it, and it gave me happiness. And thank you, algorithm. It was called Turtles All the Way Down. I use that expression all the time, not because I've read the John Green book since until this weekend, I hadn't. The title of the book is borrowed from a pre-existing anecdote, which is also used by Terry Pratchett and others. It's a good book. I feel like my John Green recommendations are out of step with most of my other recommendations on this podcast, because he is extremely, almost to the point of excruciatingly, sincere. He's a very sincere person. His podcast, Anthropocene Reviewed, is extremely sincere. His books are very sincere. They are mostly about teenagers feeling their feelings very strongly and trying to figure out the world and who they are. These are not things, any of these things, that I typically like, but John Green presents them so well that I like them anyway. So in case you are allergic to sincerity and therefore put off by this recommendation, please try not to be, because it's still pretty good stuff.
Did you find out whose fault the stars were?
See, this is the kind of snippiness I will not tolerate about my friend John Green.
Yeah, John Green is a wonderful young adult novelist, and I've read many of his books with interest and positive feelings.
So picking up on Catherine's ode to the technology that brought her a culture, I recently flew back and forth to California. Full planes, by the way. Middle seats occupied. I was in one of the middle seats. So it's kind of this, you know, semi-fraught atmosphere. And like, thank God for the seat back, like a video screen. So great. So I saw three movies. I'm not going to talk about them at all. But in order of good to greatness, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Ford versus Ferrari, and Richard Jewell. I recommend all three.
hey, Matt.
Did you cry? Like, how many of them made you cry?
Yeah.
You know what? My crying on planes is kind of, it's gone down. So I think maybe I'm really dying inside.
Is it because your baseline levels of like teary stress are so high right now that it's like not a noticeable spike on?
But are you like a Japanese soldier stuck on a remote island in the Pacific? I mean, like, what the hell, man? Like...
What does that mean? What does that question mean?
It's like, what are you talking about? Movies that are like, they might as well have been made They might as well have been made before Joe Biden entered the, you know, the Senate.
All right. Anyways, I thought they were great. And the...
yeah. I don't know.
Boom. Keep going, Matt. Know? Don't let the haters get you down.
To answer your question, Catherine, I did cry at the moment in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and this is not a spoiler, but there's like a montage of turning on the neon lights in California as the sun is setting.
Welsh.
Oh my God. I might tear up just that. Take about it. Anyways, I got to thinking about the seat back the video on demand thing, and went back and did some research on it. Introduced, shout out to Northwest Airlines. Otherwise forgotten, Northwest Airlines, but obviously popularized by JetBlue, and now just kind of it's everywhere. JetBlue, when they started doing experiments, they had like half of their fleet had the things, and half of them did not. And they they studied consumer behavior on it, and people used the bathroom less. They called the planes that had the seatback entertainment the happy plane. As opposed to the other one.
Air Soma.
Air Soma, I love it. It makes coronavirus death tubes a lot more tolerable. So,
I mean, that's what it's been like with movie theaters closed for 6 months, is that we've all not been on the happy plane.
We've been calling the stewardess more.
No, that analogy doesn't make sense, though, because we have our little screens in front of us all the time, and we have video on demand like nobody's business.
Maybe all of life is now the happy plane.
Whoa.
I think on that note, goodbye. Thank you for listening. Listen to All Reason Podcasts, reason.com/podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. And we will catch you on the proper Monday as opposed to the holiday Tuesday. And we won't talk about holidays anymore until we all take one from reality. Goodbye.